The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And I am another one of your hosts. My name is Jody Green, and I'm at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm the last host again, Michael Scavarla at Penn State University.
And we are joined in the studio today by a very special guest. A very special guest, would you mind introducing yourself to the world?
My name is Carmen Greenwood, and I'm currently an associate professor at SUNY Cobleskill, a small college in upstate New York. I'm the co-director of the Environmental Management Program, and by training, kind of an arthropod ecologist, but kind of a jack of all trades, too, because of our environmental curriculum. Arthropods are, you know, impact a lot of different aspects of the environment, so it works nicely.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's good to know that there's an entomologist that's in charge of something like that. We're very excited to have you on the show today. We are excited to get back into some entomology content. If you listen to our previous episodes, you know that we have begun a, what was it, Mike, 4, 7, 20-part series? What was it that you were saying?
100-part. It's a 4-part series.
A 4-part series on the history of interactions between Napoleon and insects. Part 1 just came out here recently. If you haven't listened to that, we hope you will go back and take a look at it. But today we're going to dig back into some entomological content and talk to Dr. Greenwood about her research. And it is focused on an insect that I have always found kind of fascinating, the American burying beetle. We had a press release, actually, that was sent to us. It seems like some very exciting news has happened for you there at SUNY Cobleskill. I always try to say those, all the New York schools, the names always trip me up.
Yeah, we are excited. We've been working a long time to make this happen. So we're trying to reintroduce the American burying beetle here in central New York. And we've put 5 years of preliminary work into finding a suitable location for it and, you know, setting it up so that it could happen.
That sounds awesome. I know that I've learned a little bit about the American burying beetle over the years, but for our listeners at home, can you introduce this handsome little insect to them and tell them a little bit about why you have to reintroduce it and what that even means?
All right, I'll try. So this particular beetle, it's a very large beetle, about 1.5 inches in length. It's black with orange markings on its back and pronotum. It's a very handsome beetle, and it's part of a group of the burying beetles as a whole. Have a very interesting behavior for reproduction. They have to find a piece of carrion, a carcass, and they bury it under the ground, and they use it as a brood chamber to rear their offspring. The burying beetles are part of a larger group of beetles that are carrion beetles in general that'll feed on carrion. So all these beetles will feed on pretty much any kind of carrion, but they're a lot more specific when it comes to picking that carcass for their brood chamber. And the American burying beetle used to exist throughout the eastern United States, even into parts of Canada, and declined rapidly back around the turn of the 20th century. and now only exists a couple populations on the periphery of its range.
Yeah, I was reading about some of those hot spots where it was encountered previously. One of them, it was listed as Oklahoma, just sort of like the whole state, and then very specifically Block Island, Rhode Island. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that is, it's the Block Island population that we're targeting, using as founders for our reintroduction effort.
I've long been interested in this beetle just because I remember when I was sort of a baby entomologist, like 13 or 14 years old, I was building my 4-H insect collection and I was putting out some pitfall traps and things of that nature. I thought I was being really cool. I was being a little scientist, and I caught a carrion beetle of some variety. I don't remember specifically what kind, but like 3 days before that, I had read about the endangered American burying beetle. And I just saw the markings on the back and I thought that I had killed a federally protected insect for my 4-H collection. And I kind of panicked a little bit, but I'm from Indiana. So it's unlikely I actually encountered the American burying beetle, right?
Yeah. That happens so often. It's so funny.
I also saw that there were some populations in Arkansas and Nebraska. Are those reintroduced populations or natural or?
No, those, I think, those were discovered. You know, okay. There's a population, Oklahoma, Arkansas area, they're kind of together, than the Nebraska population. And they're a little bit different than the, genetically different than the Rhode Island population, which is a little bit distinct.
Mike, did you ever run into them when you were in Arkansas?
Not alive, but I've got two American Bearing Beetle connections from Arkansas. The first, when I was TAing our insect taxonomy class, I was going through the teaching collection, and in like the sylphid part, there was an American Bearing Beetle that somebody had pulled from somewhere. It was a historic specimen, so like they didn't go out and collect it new, but somehow, you know, this endangered insect that we should probably protect all of the specimens for had made its way from the proper collection into the teaching collection where it could get all beat up and broken. So I repatriated it to the, like, the protected collection. The other part is one of the falconers that I knew down in Arkansas worked for a company that would, as part of environmental mitigation, would go survey for American burying beetles to make sure that there weren't any burying beetles in an area before like a development could come in or a developer could come in and, you know, mess with the environment.
The beetle that could stop bulldozers, basically.
Exactly. And he was really good at finding them. They use rotting chicken in buckets.
That's awesome. Jody, are you going to take a road trip and try and see the Nebraska ones?
I don't have plans for that, but I mean, I think one of the things I think is important to talk about is why these are so important, you know, like, how it fits into the ecological role, why we need these types of insects and critters in the world. But about that, you know, when people are like, oh, there's so many bugs, why it's just, you know, it's just a beetle, but it's more than that. And it's not just because we love bugs and right? We fight for those things. But if you could explain the impact of something like this and what it means to the environment.
I think there's a number of ways you can address that. And it's always, you know, it's always the question that people ask, why, you know, why do you want to save this? And there's a lot of things, certainly there's a lot of things that eat carrion. And I guess you can look at it from an ecological standpoint. It's obviously a very important ecological role to have things that take carrion off the landscape. There's also the biodiversity argument, you know, that we are, you know, biodiversity allows our ecosystem to be resilient. And losing pieces of it, you know, we lose that ability of the ecosystem to function. We don't know which piece is critical. And from the American burying beetle standpoint, people always say, why do you want to conserve a little insect? And I guess I don't think of it as a little insect. I mean, to me, this is the grizzly bear of sylphid beetles. You know, it's kind of like the apex species in its guild. And that happens a lot. You see those big apex species going, you know, they're the first ones to go. So it's kind of a warning, you know, that things are not going well in the landscape and other ones could go after this, right? So there's a lot of different answers to that, and kind of depends on, you know, what your viewpoint is.
So in a way, is it like an indicator species to say the reason why there's a decline is because there's something going on in the environment with like land changes and land use? And
yeah, I think that's what happened with this one. And because its biology is so complicated, you know, most people will agree that the main factor was the loss of suitable hosts for reproduction. But the loss of suitable hosts has to do with landscape changes, you know, fragmentation of the habitat, changes in community structure. So losing, you know, the loss of the passenger pigeon was thought to be an important factor because it was just the right size host. And then with habitat fragmentation, you get the increase of meso predators that compete for carrion. Human development breeds more flies, which also compete for carrion. So it's a really complex question, you know, what the things that caused it to decline. But yeah, they're all things related to anthropogenic changes on the landscape.
You touched on one of Mike's pet project or pet things, I think, is the loss of bird fauna. He actually loves talking about extinct birds and in fact has a Carolina parakeet tattoo prominently on his arm.
I do. Here, for the listeners, you can't see it, but Carolyn can.
Are you going to do the passenger pigeon on the other arm, maybe?
I was thinking about it. I did want to ask about passenger pigeons specifically, so I'm glad that you brought that up. Because back in grad school, I did my grad school in Arkansas, and I thought about American burying beetles on occasion, and at that point, I looked around in the literature because it occurred to me like, man, passenger pigeons went extinct and then American burying beetles declined. And is that related? It, 10 years ago, I couldn't find anything that had suggested that. So is that like current thinking, like the passenger pigeons went extinct and this big food source for them disappeared from the landscape and that contributed?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would suggest that was probably a big factor. And a number of other things disappeared. I guess, you know, for a while, turkeys were pretty scarce, you know, for the bird expert. there were a number of, you know, upland game birds that kind of declined around that time as well. And, you know, if we're talking about a little bit further west, you know, they also use small mammals. And some of the small mammal populations declined too, like prairie dogs and things like that. But passenger pigeons have definitely been mentioned in multiple places in the literature.
Okay. So thinking about that, what is the average, I guess, what do you call it? Prey size or carrion size or small dead animal size? Like what's the average size of the bit of carrion that they'll go for?
Carrion nugget. How big is it?
Yeah. So that, you know, it's kind of thought that that's the way that these burying beetles kind of partition themselves, right, to reduce competition between them, is the smaller burying beetles will bury small carcasses that are, you know, 40 grams or so. They can use a deer mouse or something. And then as the species get bigger, they can use gradually bigger carcasses. And burying beetles can use anywhere from, I guess, you know, depending on which, who you talk to, maybe 80 to up to 300 grams. You know, that's somewhere in that range. So there is some plasticity. You know, they have the ability to kind of cull their brood to match what resources they have available. But the bigger species in that genus tend to use bigger carcasses.
Can we talk more about what they're using it for? So we've kind of hinted at the fact they're burying it and that they like carrion and everything, but how is it that they utilize this resource? And then how do they even find it, really, I guess?
Yeah. So that's some of the really fascinating stuff with these beetles. They can smell a dead animal, I mean, supposedly up to about 2 miles away, you know, so people always talk about the blowfly as being the magic carcass finder, right? these guys compete with them. You know, they get to that carcass right away. They can get there within an hour. The males usually find them first. They have more sensitive chemoreceptors. They put out pheromones to call for a female. And the two of them together will then bury the carcass. They'll shave the hair or the feathers off of it. They'll coat it with anal and oral secretions to reduce, you know, bacteria and fungus on the surface, make it less smelly for
competition.
And they'll bury it, and then the female will construct a little brood chamber, and then the male and the female will feed on the carcass and regurgitate food to the offspring, just like little baby birds.
That's amazing.
So it's a really fascinating biology, which probably didn't help, you know, when it came to their decline. But
it sounds like a lot like my wife and I's first date, a lot of carrion and throwing up stuff. It's a beautiful process, though, because they're bonded at that point, if I understand correctly. They mate for their life. Is that right?
They do. And the male and the female both contribute to taking care of those baby beetles. You know, and the babies will beg for food. You know, it's a really
beautiful thing.
It is. They have great family values.
Oh, that might be a good subtitle for the American Bearing Beetle Family Values.
They have their poop in a group.
Or they'll also eat extra babies, so it's a little questionable. I mean,
you can't have it all.
But the ones they don't eat, they take care of in a very
good way.
So it does sound very complicated, like when they're out in nature doing this, and that could have been a factor in possibly their decline and everything. But you're talking about reintroducing them into their native habitat, and I assume that that means that you're helping them do some of this in the lab. Is that accurate?
So in the lab, we do breed them in the lab. You know, we provision them with carrion and allow them to go through their whole process so that we can create more offspring for the actual reintroduction effort. And we have a lot of help. this is not the first time this has been done. They're doing a reintroduction down in Missouri. Bob Mers and Kayla Garcia at the St. Louis Zoo. And we're using all the work that they've done as kind of our foundation. You know, we're kind of copying their protocols for this effort, including, you know, rearing the founders in captivity and things like that.
So how do you get your carrion, if I may ask?
Oh, the carrion. trying to think. Sometimes we order frozen rats. That way we can get them just the right size for the reproductive efforts. Quail are often frozen. Quail of the right size are often used for provisioning because it kind of mimics what they, you know, some of the wild birds they might find out on the landscape. So we've used both of those sources.
Would it be fair to say you have a stinky lab, or are the secretions that they produce helpful?
If they're doing everything right, it actually doesn't smell at all.
That's cool. We once had a guest who worked with dung beetles, and he told us about scooping poop out with an ice cream scooper and how that could be quite a smelly lab. Do you remember that, Jody, with Matt Bertone? Yeah.
What kind of substrate do they use to bury it?
So they bury the soil, and they need, you know, that's probably the most important factor besides host availability is having good, soft, loamy soil that they can bury in. They need to bury, you know, at least, you know, 10 centimeters down or so, you know, try and get it covered up. And so they need to have good soil. A lot of studies have been done on what they prefer for habitat. And the above ground doesn't seem to matter so much. You know, they do reproduce in woodlands and grasslands and things like that, but they need to have good soil.
Can we talk more about the project that kind of helped introduce you to the show here today? You have received a grant, correct? And mm-hmm. I was trying to remember exactly the granting agency and everything. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Yeah. The funding comes from the Fish and Wildlife Service, who are in charge of endangered species. And it comes through a Recovery Challenge grant, which is specifically designed to support reintroduction efforts and things that will help restore endangered and threatened species. So, you know, we've proposed this. This is a 5-year project, and that's not unusual for reintroduction. It's probably going to take a while for them to establish. So each year we'll be doing the reproduction in the founding colony and putting beetles out twice a year, two different times, probably around the month of June. So to get prior to getting the funding, we conducted about 5 years worth of survey efforts looking at different sites and the host populations in the different areas, you know, soil types and things like that. And putting together, and the Fish and Wildlife Service asks us to do a minimum of 2 year survey work before deeming a site acceptable. Right. So that's not really unusual.
So there's a lot of preparatory work that goes in before you can actually even begin the reintroduction process. I don't think that's something that a lot of people are familiar with. So you have to go out and you have to find where you're going to put them, right? And get it certified as a good spot. And then how do you start getting the beetles? Like, what are some of those beginning steps to this process?
Oh, so our founding population is going to come from Roger Williams Zoo in Rhode Island. And we're working with Lou Parati. He's the Beetlemeister out there at Roger Williams Zoo. And also a couple other people. I'm trying to remember everybody now. Cindy with the Fish and Wildlife Service. Scott with the Nature Conservancy out on Block Island. Those guys take care of the beetles out there on Block Island, you know, and make sure that that population is staying healthy. And so they are all working with us on this project to provide us with founders, the whole thing. It's a really massive.
It does. It sounds like a big beetle operation that's going on out there.
Yeah. And so, we have other, lots of collaborators on this project.
Once you get them out there, what are some of the next steps that are involved? Like, how are you going to make sure that it's not just you constantly reintroducing them? How do we make sure that they're starting to take off on their own?
So that's probably going to be the most challenging part, I think. These beetles are extremely mobile. You know, you set them free and they'll fly. You know, they can up and fly 12 miles, you know, in a single day. And they have to be because of their lifestyle. They have to fly around finding those hosts. So they need a good amount of landscape to operate in to start with. We have techniques for monitoring, and that is the biggest thing that we're all kind of working on right now, is how best to monitor to see that they're actually surviving. You know, so we'll do around the release site, we'll do a perimeter of multiple perimeters of trapping to see if we can recapture some of the beetles that we released or their offspring, you know, in the future. We're hoping that some of this technology, you know, that we can put a little tag on a beetle actually gets small enough that we can and feel comfortable enough doing that. It's, you know, it's really good for bigger animals, but not quite there yet, I think.
Yeah. It'd be hard to radio or microchip a beetle.
Yeah. I wish we could. That's the one thing we're kind of stewing over now, is some of the best monitoring techniques.
So how many sites do you have, and how many beetles are you planning on releasing, like, at that site or sites? Like, is it just like 10 or 20 beetles a year, or is it going to be multiple hundreds?
I wish. unfortunately, because we're dealing with such a small, delicate population out there on Black Island, we can't have giant founder populations. So we're hoping our first release will be about 20 breeding pairs. And we have one site, you know, to start with, and we're continuing to survey additional sites. But because the population that we're releasing is so small, I think we're going to stick to one site for the first year. And hopefully that'll give us best opportunity to see if they succeed. It is a good site, though. It's surrounded by a lot of, you know, state land, protected lands. So I think to me, it seems, you know, the denser the host population in an area, maybe the less they'll disperse. So, you know, picking a good site will hopefully help with that.
A follow-up on that. How big is the brood size? Like, how many beetles, how many offspring do you get per pair if they are successful?
So I think, you know, they can have anywhere from, or start with anywhere from about 10 to 30.
Okay.
I think it'd be very unusual for them to actually, for, you know, 30 larvae to actually make it to pupation, though. More often it's probably closer to 10 or in the teens, maybe.
So not very many.
No, and it's really related to how much, what's the size of the carcass.
Mm-hmm. Sort of bouncing off of the brood size question, maybe we could talk a little bit. It sounds like there's a lot of help in the pre-preparatory process, but are you doing this all alone, or do you have a lab brood that's quite large that's helping you with this as well, or
who's going
to the field with you?
No, I could never do this alone. so I have a couple of collaborators here in the department. I feel like I have just the perfect team, actually, for this award. I have a couple of faculty members in the department, Amy Quinn and Roger Massey. They're wildlife faculty. Amy works with small mammals, and Roger is a bird expert. They've both been handling the host survey part. And I have also collaborating with Matt Schlesinger, who's the chief zoologist in the Natural Heritage Program. And the Natural Heritage Program in New York does manage the endangered species at the state level. So he has been just absolutely critical in navigating the agency side, permits and regulations. It's a massive undertaking. And with me and Amy and Roger, we've had, oh my gosh, over, you know, every year we have 5 or 6 students working over the summer as interns, surveying mammals, birds, beetles, you know, in different places. It's been a big group effort, you know, and there's more people. Jess for our instructional support people, Jess and Eric, you know, within the, just supervising everybody and making sure that we have all the supplies that we need. Yeah, it's been a huge effort.
Yeah, you mentioned the permitting process. I imagine for dealing with an endangered species, I imagine that was something else to deal with, like the just bureaucratic paperwork and trying to get everything approved? Or was that not as onerous as maybe you would expect?
It's extremely onerous. And
fair enough.
Yeah, and it's not something I'm used to, you know, coming from the academic side. So Matt works with the New York DEC, the state agency, and he's been really helpful navigating that. Yeah, that's really a challenge. And they're great people, you know, the people in the agencies, you know, Fish and Wildlife and DEC, they're really great to work with. It's just there's so much red tape that goes with all these processes.
So does that go into some of the greatest challenges that you've had along the way?
Yes. That would, for me, it's the biggest challenge. It's just that it's just not understanding every single step, every form, every permit, every regulation. And I rely really heavily on those, you know, those collaborators to help with that.
Do you have any students doing projects or postdocs doing long-term, like looking at the research behind what you're doing? And
so we do. We have a researcher coming. Hopefully coming. We hired a researcher to come and kind of be a partner in the project. And we haven't, you know, made anything official yet. He's a postdoc who's worked with burying beetles throughout his academic career. With Curtis Creighton up in Purdue, and he's going to be joining us to help with the scientific aspects, you know, making sure, you know, we want everything to be science-based. You know, we want to publish some of our work with host availability and seasonal dynamics and things like that. So as soon as we get all the administrative pieces in order, he'll be joining our team too.
You made all our ears perk up. We're all three graduates of Purdue University. There's three Boilermakers on the podcast today. I guess I have a question that's maybe a little more philosophical rather than practical. It's sort of a, what does it feel like to intervene on behalf of this endangered insect and on the behalf of something that used to be such a ubiquitous part of our landscape, it sounds like, but has disappeared? I mean, how does that feel? What is it like to help intervene on its behalf?
I guess to me, this is, you know, it's the most important thing. As long as I've been working, you know, ever since grad school, it's been a long time now, I've always been really interested in conservation. You know, I've been fascinated with insects and other arthropods, you know, just their behavior, everything that they do, everything about them. And I've been interested in conservation from the start. And back then, when I first started, not very many entomologists were conservationists. You know, a lot of them were working on killing insects and things. And so it was kind of unusual. And unfortunately, for me, what I'm seeing now, you know, more and more and more insects are in trouble. You see it every day, right? New ones. And so to me, it's just extraordinarily sad. So being able to do this was really, really exciting. It doesn't even feel real yet, honestly.
Well, kind of on that note, I mean, when I hear about the American burying beetle and the Salt Creek tiger beetle when I was out in Nebraska, and Jody has been around some of that as well, when we see these sort of classical stories of endangered and nearly extinct insects, how do you talk to people about that? Do you pair it with something like this insect apocalypse that's been going on in the news in the most recent, in some of the recent years, or are they connected at all, or is that sort of a bridge too far?
No, I you know, if insects are the things, you know, to quote all the famous biologists, right, they're the kind of things that keep the world functioning. They're the things that keep the ecosystem functioning, insects and plants. And when you see insects in trouble going extinct, if that isn't a big wake up call, I don't know what is, you know. I mean, we're all, it can, you can look at it from a functional standpoint, you know, all the little pieces of, that provide every ecosystem service, or you can look at the biodiversity standpoint, you know, they're, just the diversity of species and their behavior and things like that. But, we're losing insects, you know, we're already losing all the bigger major animals, and now we're losing insects. I think it's just a real important wake up call.
It's frightening to think about.
Yeah, it is.
So, and I'm not sure how I want to phrase this. How successful do you think this will be given landscape fragmentation and the fact that they're not there anymore? Like, I think of examples like elk that were widespread and we reintroduced to Pennsylvania, and you don't, like, we have a breeding population here and they're established, but they don't really move outside where we put them, versus something like wild turkeys where they almost went extinct. We stopped shooting them and reintroduced them other places, and now they're ubiquitous everywhere that there's any kind of little forest patch. So two very different, like, success stories. Like, we've saved them both, but in one took off and one didn't. I guess, how do you think American burying beetles will respond if we can get them established? Are they gonna spread back throughout the landscape? Is it a matter of just getting them out there, or are we gonna put them in these pockets and they stay there and they breed, but they don't really expand past that?
I think there's some encouraging results coming from the Missouri reintroduction. There, it looks like that, you know, they are adjusting, they're persisting, they're finding new hosts on the landscape, and they're catching beetles, you know, that are reproducing on the landscape. So that is hopeful that the landscape community has kind of repopulated, you know, it's not the same animals, but repopulated with different animals that will fill that required slot. I think the longer we wait, the more dangerous it is, because that little population on Black Island is living in a situation that is so protected, you know, it's not so different from the mainland. And I think, you know, just waiting year after year, they kind of lose some of their plasticity to adjusting to the mainland. So I think it's going to be a little harder with these than it was with the Missouri beetles. I don't know if it'll succeed or not. I think that there's a really good community of hosts available, again, different hosts. And one of the indicators we use that, you know, that we think it might work is that the other burying beetles in the genus, you know, the other species, are more abundant. And a lot of them have bigger bodies, like they've kind of filled in that niche that's left vacant by American burying beetle. And so even where American burying beetle currently exists, those congeners exist too, but they exist at lower numbers, and they tend to have smaller body sizes to, you know, to kind of, they're partitioning that way. And in some of these locations we've surveyed, we find pretty big beetles. They're bigger using the big hose because American burying beetle's not there. At least that's what we're hoping. And large numbers of them. So
that's really cool.
So ABB could come in and be another competitor, but and they're not, these sister species numbers would probably go down, and they may have to switch to smaller hosts. But we think that there's room there for ABB.
When will you be making some of these first releases?
We're hoping for the June of 22.
Gotcha.
We're getting our founder population this late summer this year. We'll have to do some breeding in captivity to build up their numbers, which we'll all be on, you know, glass watching that happen. And then we'll release them on a couple different occasions in the summer next year.
I smell a road trip in the future.
Yeah, that's really exciting to get them more widely established in the Northeast. I mean, I'm in State College, Pennsylvania. I'm not too far away from where you're at. So the idea of having American bearing beetles on the landscape in this area is really exciting.
Oh, man. And the ones in Block Island are huge.
You know, that's so cool.
They're so big, which also worries me. You know, so people... hope people won't be afraid of them just because they're big.
Oh. going off your comment about them all being in one locality out here, I guess, is there worried about stochastic events like the once in 100-year hurricane sliding up that way and destroying that population somehow?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we're doing it twice. And we learned that from Bob down in Missouri. Because they had that happen.
Oh, really?
They did one reintroduction event and had a horrible storm come through and wash them all away. So they switched to having two events every summer. Exactly for that reason.
You got to fight against mankind and nature in that sense.
Yeah.
Well, I was kind of curious if there was anywhere that our listeners could keep watch on this, or like if you have anything where they can see updates on when your releases are happening and how things are going.
We are in the process of creating a webpage. So we will have, you know, regular updates and hopefully some footage of everything related to the project. It is not ready yet, but I could provide it to you if you have any way of providing it to your listeners.
Yeah, we can definitely tweet that out in the future when it's ready. We would love to keep an eye on this situation. And I wasn't kidding when I said something about a road trip. I would love to come up and see the beetles getting released at some point in the future. We could take a video and make a little thing about it, but I think it would be amazing to see. So do you have any other pluggables that are out there? Or are you on Twitter, or are you an Instagrammer? Do you have a bug Instagram?
We're in the early stages, so I don't have any of those things. I'm at this point.
Maybe in the future, a TikTok for American bearing beetles or something.
Yes, it's all coming.
Well, we're very excited about your project, and we appreciate that y'all reached out and wanted to be a part of Arthropod. We thank you for your time today, and we hope everybody listening enjoyed learning about American bearing beetles and Dr. Greenwood's research. If you want to find the show, we're on the web at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter at BugmanJohn.
I'm at JodyBugsMe, UNL.
And I'm at MScavarla36, still.
we hope to hear more about American bearing beetles in the future. Maybe a future update episode with Dr. Greenwood will be in order.
Yeah. Hey, maybe you said 2022. Maybe I'll drive up there and post COVID, we can have an outdoor interview and watch some beetles get released.
You should. You should do live coverage of the release.
I would be super stoked to do that.
Yeah. And I have never seen an American bearing beetle, but I've been looking at the iNaturalist in Nebraska and looking to see who's doing the work. And I am going to reach out to, I think it's the Nebraska Game and Parks that have been doing the surveying and find out about them. I know the student that was recently, I guess it was in the last couple years, I guess featured in the UNL newsroom. She wasn't an entomologist, so she's not particularly fond of bugs. So I should reach out to her. Maybe she could show me any of her beetles.
That'll be amazing. We thank you all for tuning in and look forward to another episode here in the near future for more buggy goodness.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.